Hey everybody, Vespi here. Now, I usually don't jump in at the start of these things, but today's episode is a special one in more ways than one. That's right, Wil Wheaton returned to the show to talk about the 40th anniversary of Stand By Me, the late great Rob Reiner. Prepare yourselves now, by the way, it gets very emotional. Maybe a tear or two is shed, who's to say? And he's also here to talk about his brand new audiobook narration of King's novella of The Body. The reason I'm jumping in here right at the top is to encourage you folks to stick around at the end of the interview, because the good folks at Simon & Schuster have given us a lengthy preview of Wil Wheaton's narration of The Body. So not only do you get your normal KingCast experience with me and Bresnikan asking nerdy questions of our guests and grilling them about Stephen King shenanigans, you're also going to get a big chunk from Will's audiobook narration. It is really good. I'm very excited. Thank you so much to the folks at Simon & Schuster for providing it. The audiobook is out now wherever you get your audiobooks. So if you like what you hear, go pick it up. And yeah, make sure you don't dip out when the interview is over or you're going to miss the good stuff. And of course, before we start, I also have to do my usual, give you the house ad read. Fangoria has been at it for over 40 years and is better than ever. This magazine, it's not only gorgeous, it's highly collectible and delivered right to your door four times a year, with each issue is filled to the brim with articles exploring every nook and cranny of genre filmmaking, past, present, and future, with all the most exciting journalists, filmmakers, and horror know-it-alls to guide the way, including little old me from time to time. This high-quality writing will only ever appear within the physical pages of the magazine, never online, so if you want to join in on the fun, you're going to need to subscribe. And in order to do that, all you got to do is head on over to fangoria.com and sign up. And when you do that, use the code KingCast at checkout, and you will save an astronomical 25% off of your subscription. That is fangoria.com, code KingCast. Now on with the show.
Hi. My name is Stephen King.
The ice is gonna break!
Bad Rob!
If I just wanna go see a dead body.
Well, sometimes dead is better.
Welcome back to the KingCast on the Fangoria Podcast Network. I'm Anthony Bresnikan.
I'm Eric Vespi.
And our guest today, Eric, he hardly needs an introduction, because chances are, if you're listening to this, you grew up with him. He starred as Gordy Lachance in Rob Reiner's landmark coming-of-age drama, Stand By Me. He appeared in that film alongside River Phoenix, Corey Feldman, Jerry O'Connell, Kiefer Sutherland. It's just a treasure of a movie. And if that was the only thing he did, that would still be amazing. But he was also Wesley Crusher in Star Trek The Next Generation, a role he has reprised lately on Picard and the animated Star Trek Prodigy. He's a prominent voice actor who, again, started as a kid as the little brother Mouse in The Secret of Nim. That's an old school callback for us Gen X people. He played himself on The Big Bang Theory. He's narrated many audiobooks, including the very geek-friendly Ready Player One and Red Shirts. And we're talking to him today on the KingCast because he is back in King Country with Stand By Me and a new audiobook version of the novella The Body. He was a kid when the movie came out. Now he's giving voice to the grown-up Gordy as he tells this heart-wrenching tale from childhood. So please welcome Mr. Wil Wheaton to the KingCast. Woo!
Really, really cool to be back, you guys.
The new audiobook version is out on March 24th, so people who love this story can revisit it in a new way. Wil, the thing I thought was extraordinary about your performance of this book is it feels like a one-man show. It feels like I'm watching a guy on stage, you know, those classic stories where someone's up there telling telling the tale, like a Bronx Tale started out as a one man show. And I think it's because I can picture you. I can picture you now. I can picture you as a boy. And the faces of your co-stars from that movie are kind of indelible. So tell us what it was like for you to come back. How did this project originate? And tell us about your feelings about revisiting this text.
Thank you for saying so many kind things about my work. I am so grateful, and it is such a privilege that I got to do this. It was years in the making. Since Ready Player One, I've really made the focus of my career audiobook narration, and I love it. And it has become how I express myself as an artist. And it's kind of what I hope to do with the rest of my career until I retire. I've been real lucky over the last 15 or 20 years. I have just met an uncountable number of people who have said that they really like the way that I narrate audiobooks and that they will get anything that I narrate. And like, when are you going to do the body? Like over and over and over and over again, right? And then there would be there's also a particular person who says, like, hey, you know, like, this is, it's the future and the internet exists. Like, what if you just recorded all of Dreyfus's dialogue from the movie and like made it an MP3 and we could put it together? And I was like, that's incredibly disrespectful to his performance. No, I will not do that. But that idea of narrating the novella stayed with me. And, you know, I know that things take a very long time, right? I know that it takes a lot of time to get permission to do things. I know that it takes a long time for all the people who have to say yes to say yes. So a couple of years ago, I got my team together and I said, the 40th anniversary of Stand By Me is coming up. And I think it would be a really great idea if we could get permission for me to narrate the body. It's a meaningful anniversary. It's a piece of work that I've wanted to do for the longest time. And it was so hard just to get anybody to call us back. And we finally got contacted by Simon & Schuster beginning of like middle of last year. And they were like, hey, so do you want to do this? Like, I mean, I've only been asking for a couple of years. Yeah, I really want to do this. It came together very quickly. I have had the extraordinary privilege of working with a director named Gabrielle DeCure for about 20 years. We've done a lot of bestsellers together. We've won some awards together. She directs my podcast. And I knew that we were going to be a really good creative team on this story, because she knows me very well, and I know me very well, and I know Gordy very well, and I knew the material very well. And I just wanted to do an honest and grounded version of this story. And I wanted to bring the experience that I have as a 53-year-old father to telling the story that I've been telling since 1986. I wanted to bring the experience that I have and use the instrument I've worked so hard to develop to do today what Rod Reiner allowed me to do 40 years ago, which is be Gordy and tell his story. And in the movie, I'm telling Gordy's story in real time as a kid. Audiobook narration, I'm telling Gordy's story, which is my story, through the lens of memory. The novella is very different from the movie. You know, the movie has this really beautiful and warm, nostalgic, bittersweet memory to it, right? I mean, it's very much, I think that the tone of the movie is really captured at the very, very end when it's a close-up on Rick when he's looking at the screen and it's before he writes the last few lines. And, you can see his kid says, yeah, my dad's weird. And I love that moment because it reminds me of Chris saying, yeah, you're weird. Everybody's weird. And you see this moment where Rick goes, God, I miss that guy. And he finishes it, right? In the novella, he's hurting. Gordy's hurting. He's trying so hard to communicate to whoever is listening what Chris Chambers meant to him, what this time in his life meant to him, and how Chris saw in him what he didn't see in himself. And because Chris saw that, now he's a writer and he's a storyteller and this is his life. And please, please, reader, please understand. And he says over and over again, the most important things to say are the hardest things to say because the words just fuck it all up. Yeah. You're like, you stumble all over the place.
Yeah.
And it's not that somebody isn't gonna listen to you. It's that they're not gonna hear you when you're trying to say these things. So it comes from a really different place. And it was real important to all of us involved in the creative side of this that we were very aware that if you haven't read the book and you've only seen the movie, it can be a little jarring that the book is a little bit darker and a little bit more intense. And it was really lovely and wonderful to lean into that and explore that aspect of this character who I've been playing in one way or another since I was 12 years old.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting hearing you talk about this because one of my main questions going into this was, how much is this narration Will Wheaton narrating and how much of it is adult Gordon LaChance? Not Gordy, Gordon LaChance narrating, yeah. Right? And yeah. It sounds like it, you know, that there's like, you know, half of one, or what, half a dozen of one and six of the other, whatever the saying goes. You know, it sounds like that a lot of that's rolled up and, you know, into you as a person at this point. And I remember in your previous appearance, you were talking about how, you know, and I've seen you say this in a bunch of interviews, especially recently now that the 40th is here and everybody's wanting to talk to you about Stand By Me, you know, talking about just how, you know, Rob's genius in casting that movie was casting. He didn't cast for those characters. He cast those characters, and he somehow saw that each one of you was that person in real life. So, you know, is it something that you feel like you have to shake, that, you know, that Gordon, that Gordy LaChance of you, or is it something that you fully embrace at this point, you think?
Trying to think how I want to come. This is a big answer. There are a lot of really.
Well, to be fair, I did ask about 7 questions and one rambling thing. So you got a little grace.
Listen, just where I am in this moment, right, at this, while we are doing this, this is just a couple of days after we remembered Rob at the Oscars. And I'm feeling a lot of really big feelings. And I'm in the middle of a lot of sadness right now. But a lot of sadness and a lot of just gratitude and remembering with such fondness and such joy that not only did Rob really cast kids who were our characters, right? And he talked about that when you're casting kids, you cannot put into a kid something that isn't there. You know, we have to find, because when we're kids, we just don't have the experience. We haven't lived enough to know we know how to be who we are. And having cast kids who were those, you know, were those kids, he made it safe for us to be exactly who we were. And for me, I had been told my whole life by both of my parents that I wasn't good enough being who I was, that I wasn't enough, that there was something really wrong with me, that that I was unlovable. That, you know, that I was always the problem, that all of those things Gordy's dad says about him is the world. That's what I grew up in. And it's very much how I felt as a kid. And Rob created an environment on the set where I could experience the sadness of that and channel it into a performance without me ever knowing that's what I was doing. He just encouraged me to follow my instincts, and he constantly was thanking us and praising us and like reaffirming for us, you know, how scenes went. I'm sure that I have talked about this before, maybe with you. Before we began production, we spent 2 weeks on location doing rehearsals and kind of like blocking scenes and doing the rehearsals and stuff, but then going back to the hotel and playing theater games and doing improv exercises. Rob, I saw him in an interview. Rob talked about how he was kind of teaching us how to be an ensemble and how to trust each other and how to show up for each other and kind of like how to be kind of like Stella Adler inspired actors. And for
it sounds, he's also just creating friendship that you're, you know,
yes. Yes, absolutely.
Let these kids play.
He's creating an environment where we can play. He is making it okay for us to be friends. He's removing any kind of weird competition that there may have been. There wasn't, but that could have shown up. And he is making it so that we can be those kids without being self-conscious and without trying to act. The one time in the entire production that I was trying to act was when Jerry and I were running away from the train. And it's a famous story of us acting scared and not being scared. And Rob coming out and yelling at us and scaring us and like doing what he needed to do to get us scared. And I remember him saying, if you're not going to be like yelling at us, if you're not afraid of that train, be afraid of me. And Jerry and I looked at each other and burst into tears because Rob was our father figure. And we were like, oh my God, he's mad at us. We've let him down. And we start crying and I could see Rob go like this, like roll the camera, roll the camera, roll the camera, action. And the next take is the take that's in the movie. After we filmed that, you know, Jerry and I ran off the train tracks, ran past the camera, ran to Rob. He put his arms around us, kissed us each on top of our head. And he said, thank you. You did such a good job. And I'm sorry I scared you, but that was great. That was the environment that we were in.
So I need people to focus on that part of the story too, because I've seen people try to take that out of context and talk about how he was like he made the kids cry on the set, and that's the only part of it. And it frustrates me, especially now. Like, and I think it's really irresponsible in this moment to try to reframe that.
You got to be pretty twisted to see that for any way anything other than it is. You know, anybody who's actually a parent knows sometimes you have to, like, you know how animals like birds or bears will puff themselves up, you know, sometimes with a kid you've got to be like, no, like, I'm really angry at you for reaching out for that hot stove, like, just to make an impression. So, like, that's not scarring them. And now, had he dangled you over the trellis by one leg, you know, that might
that's
not
a whole
have
different
been so
story
cool.
But
that
they were totally been, into it was
that's
time.
More of a Werner Herzog move, but
yeah, I mean, William Friedkin move.
They're not doing Scorpion, thank god. You know, I think that it's a really important lesson about parenting also in that moment. You know, my dad was a screamer, just never stopped yelling at me, and it lost all of its power. It just became this thing that I was just like, oh God, he's yelling again. Rob never raised his voice to us, never once. But in that moment, he did, and it mattered, right? And we listened. And then afterwards, he was like, let me re-regulate you guys. Let me make it all okay for you again. You know, it wasn't unsafe. It wasn't cruel. I've been abused on the set, and Stand By Me was not that.
Well, do you think, I don't know what Rob's relationship was to your parents, but here's a guy who grew up with a director father, started acting again at a very early age. I think he was a teenager when he started, so a little bit older than you were. But do you think he recognized something in the way you and your parents were relating? Again, you said he was connecting the kid to the character. Gordy's parents look past him. They're wrapped up in their own grief and trauma, and they don't even notice him. You know, there's that really sad scene at the end where he kind of mouths off to his mom, ain't that a bitch, when she talks about walking by her dead son's room. And she goes, wait, what did you say? And he goes, it's not important. You know, even when he tries to, like, hurt them to get them to see him, he just sort of backs off. Do you think Rob saw what was happening with you?
I don't know that. So my parents were extraordinarily skilled at deceiving everyone. You know, they both really protected how cruel my dad was. And, you know, my mom just, like, created the story of us being this really perfect, amazing family, and then just did whatever she had to maintain that illusion. I don't know that he knew anything about that, but I do know that anyone with even one piece of empathy and compassion in their character build would have looked at 12-year-old me and seen how sad and scared I was. It's just, you know, it's just on my face. It's in my body language. It's on my shoulders. It's kind of who I was. I was sad and I was scared and I was lonely. And I was a sweet kid who really had some wonderful things to bring into the world. And just like Gordy was a beautiful little kid who was an incredible storyteller. And Chris Chambers says to him, you know, if your fucking parents can't figure that out and can't see that and don't care about it, then, like, I'm going to do that. I will be there for you. I think that's the moment that inspires Gordon LaChance to write about this story. It inspires him to write The Body. is that moment, right? Like, I imagine that 10 years after Chris Chambers has died, and this is Gordon LaChance in his 30s, which, you know, I know now, I was in my 30s 20 years ago, and like, I'm very different now than I was then. That gave me a real, it was a real asset in the preparation of the material and my understanding of the material, because I have lived through all of the things he lived through.
Hmm.
And I was able to apply my own experience. Like, you know, I've done the work, man. Like, I've done a lot of work to work on the CPTSD I have from being a kid, and to heal a lot of the wounds from my, you know, from my family. And I can bring the experience of this person I am now, a person who's done a lot of work, who's really healed, to tell this story in a way that is not like reliving it while I'm going all through it, which is not right for this text, right? I mean, it's very much like, oh my God, I really want you to understand. I really want you to hear this. I really just need you to know this is how I got here. And I owe it to these guys. And maybe you have those people in your life too. And like, I lost the one who meant the most to me. So if you still have them in your life, tell them you love them.
Mm. We are two days away from when you appeared at the Oscars with Jerry O'Connell, and Kiefer was up there, and Meg Ryan, Billy Crystal, Carrie Elwes, Christopher Guest. I mean, it was hard at first watching it to clock everybody, you know?
Cusack and Zuniga, and Cusack obviously got the overlap with Stand By Me as well, yeah.
Tell us about that night, if you can. What are your memories from this tribute to Rob Reiner?
About a month ago, Billy Crystal reached out to some of us because they wanted to remember him for the memoriam segment. It was really important. First of all, I was just so grateful to be asked. It was such an honor and a privilege to be included. Everything that is good in my life right now began with Stand By Me and Rob Reiner. It was very important to me that I stand up to remember him, to be included in that company was overwhelming, but weirdly, I didn't feel like a tourist. Weirdly, I felt like, yeah, we're all kind of in the same little club right now. And I looked around that room, I was standing next to Jerry. I looked around that room. We had all gone backstage, all of us, before we went out. And I saw, you know, all of Rob's friends talking with each other and remembering him. And Jerry leaned over to me and he said, every single person in this room got their start with Rob. Look at the people in this room. There are so many Academy Awards in this room. There are so many legendary, iconic performances in this room. And we're part of that. And we're part of that because Rob trusted us and saw something in us and chose to trust us to help tell his stories. Every one of us that was there. And it was just, you know, I was talking to, you know, to some of the people who were there, absolutely astonished that they know I exist, floored and speechless when Billy Crystal told me he knew my story. He knew my story from my memoir about my life. I don't know why he ever would have, I don't know why, but he did. And he told me how much Rob loved what I did as Gordy, because Rob saw in me so much of himself. And Rob saw that there was something in me that was hurting The same way there was something in Rob that was hurting. The same way that there was something in Gordy that was hurting. And that it really mattered to Rob. And that it was a really important part of telling this story, which is so deeply personal to him. And that's the thing that I didn't know. I didn't know then how much it was going to mean to me. I had no idea how much it meant to Rob. There's an interview that he gave a few years ago talking to the Television Academy where he talks about how when he was working on our movie, it was so important to him because this was the kind of story he wanted to tell. He wanted to tell stories about people, and he wanted to tell stories about relationships. And he had done satire, and he had done improv, and he had done a romantic comedy, and his dad had done all of those things. And he really needed to separate himself from his dad, not in a competitive way, but just in a way to like set himself aside and have the career that he wanted to have after those movies. And if Stand By Me hadn't been what it was, he was afraid that he wasn't going to get that. We never felt once, he never brought the weight of that to us in a way that was a burden. He brought that opportunity and the excitement and the enthusiasm for it to the set, and he encouraged us to be kids. He encouraged us to be friends. He encouraged us to follow our instincts and to just be relaxed and like to play and to just be those kids in that story, having that adventure together. And he was the first director I had worked with. By that point in my life, I'd done a ton of stuff and I'd been working for a really long time. And my experience with directors was that they never talked to me like I was a person. They never talked to me like I had any experience or knew what I was doing. They were vaguely threatening and they did a lot of like giving me a line reading and expecting me to mimic it. And, you know, like I know how to hit a mark. I don't need you to grab me by the elbow and move me around. Like I had no idea what I'm doing. And by the time I was like 11, I really resented the way a lot of directors treated me. Cause I was like, I wasn't making the connection, but I was like, Jesus, you treat me the way my dad does. You know, like the only time he pays attention to me is to tell me that I'm doing something wrong. Bob directed us. Bob asked us questions about our character's emotional state and about our experience. And how do you feel about this? And, well, has this ever happened in your life? And what would you do? And, okay, in rehearsal, you went up on this line. Let's try to tuck it under a little bit and see if that changes. Just try it. And then you tell me how it feels. I learned how to be an actor at Rob Reiner's feet. I didn't want to be an actor. My mom forced me to be an actor. I wanted to be a kid. I wanted to go to school. I wanted to learn about history, and I wanted to be a writer. But when I was on that set and I worked with Rob, I discovered, oh, I'm an artist. I am an artist. I am a storyteller. I love art. I love being an artist. Like, I didn't want to be an actor, but I did want to be an artist. And I could be an artist who told stories by being an actor, but someday I'm going to be an artist who tells stories by writing them. And now I am an artist who is a storyteller narrating audiobooks on my podcast and narrating The Body and you know, saying yes every opportunity I have when someone comes to me and says, hey, would you do my book? And that all started with Rob Reiner looking at me kind of like Chris looks at Gordy and saying, like, there's something really special about you, kid. And your parents are too fucked up to see it, but I do. I see it. And he just helped bring out the best in every single one of us. So we were in that room, and all of it, it was overwhelming. And when we walked out on stage, it's all a blur and it's very surreal. I looked at my wife to like ground myself to the moment and connect to her. And then as I looked back towards just the center of the house, Benicio del Toro and I locked eyes, which was so surreal and so weird. And he kind of nodded at me. And I just thought, Rob Reiner meant so much to so many people. And we are so lucky that we had him as long as we did. And we are so lucky that he shared his gift of storytelling and his love of art with the world. And I'm so grateful that he is part of my story. And I am so grateful that he is part of my life. And I am fucking heartbroken that I didn't get to tell him that.
You don't think he knew?
I'm sure he did.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm sure he did. I mean, he talked about it. He talked about that he loved us. And he talked about being proud of us. You know, there are several long, unbroken takes in Stand By Me. Just long oners. There's one that is like just the, we're coming like this on the train tracks, you know, right before the train dodge scene. And it just keeps, you know, it's a long scene. Then there's after the junkyard, after, you know, when Teddy's trying to put himself together after yelling at Milo. That is this one long shot with the most sublime comedic timing of Jerry starting to sing Have Gun Will Travel. And the three of us trying to help our friend, right? Helping get our friend out of a hole. It's all one take. And Rob was so proud of it. And he talked about it in interviews over and over and over again. You can't do that with kids. You can't. It's so hard. Kids get in our heads and we try, you know? And like, he created an environment where we didn't have to try. We could just be. It was just like, good, go. And I remember doing those scenes and never once stopping to think, don't fuck up because we can't. There's no cuts. There's nowhere to go. Like, we, you know, we can't go back. There's no way to start this over. I know, you know, he talked about how proud of us he was. And I know that he knew all of that. I just really, I'm in a place now where like I have questions and I have things that I wanted to share with him.
I can't help but feel like the thing you're going through matches so much what Gordy goes through with Chris. Those two characters loved each other. And in fact, when I first discovered what had happened to Rob, I think one of the really painful things about this whole experience for people outside of his immediate circle, it's horrible for them. But even for us who are just admirers of his, let alone people like you who worked with him and knew him, it's just very painful to think about a violent end, a tragic end in terms of his son, the son he'd tried to help. It's so opposite all of the good things that he presented in his life. And I couldn't help but immediately think, this is what happened to Chris Chambers, is he was always the best at making peace. He's confronted with somebody who's been in some institutions and is going through a crisis. When I read that section, when I heard you narrate it, it brought it back just how similar this is. Both people, the fictional Chris Chambers and the real life Rob Reiner, died from violence, from similar violence, from a knife attack. And I wondered what you make of that. I know it's a coincidence. I'm not saying the two are linked in any way that like one inspired the other, but both are people who were taken before their time while trying their best to help someone. And what do you make of that?
I've not thought about it in these terms. In both cases, it is a tragic, avoidable loss that I will feel for the rest of my life. Understand that the Rob Reiner I knew for 3.5 months in 1985, he wasn't just the director of a movie. He was our mentor. He was our father figure. He was our big brother. He was our uncle who would go get into just a little bit of trouble with us. He made us safe. I know I keep saying that, but it's rare. At least it was then. I don't know what it's like now, but that's the Rob Reiner I knew. I did not know Rob as an adult. I did not know him the way I know my cast from Star Trek. I know them as adults, but I never knew Rob as an adult. I remembered Rob as the father figure who made me feel seen and loved and special and encouraged. So that's who I lost. I know that he's a different, you know, he was Billy's best friend. They knew each other through every stage of their lives. Every other person who was in that room, they knew him and worked with him and related to him, adult to adult. Jerry and I, and Fred, were the only kids that were there who got to experience Rob as a father figure. And I didn't talk with Fred about it, but Jerry and I have talked about it. Jerry and Corey and I have talked about it.
Thanks for sharing that, Will.
Yeah.
I know it's raw, but I'm grateful to you for opening up like this. And, you know, I think it was one of the really wonderful things about that presentation at the Oscars is it gave this sort of worldwide family that Rob Reiner had, who knew him through his stories, a chance to have their memorial.
There are so many pieces of entertainment vying for attention right now. We are living in a moment where the line between creating art and telling a story and making content is so blurred. And it feels to me like the oligarchs running media companies just want to make content. They don't care about art. They don't care about storytelling. They don't care about how it affects people. They just want to make content and like monetize your eyeballs and bullshit like that. When I was at the Oscars, I saw this celebration of art. And it was weird, man. Like, you know, I'm around these people who are larger than life in theory, but when you're close to them, they're just people. And they are artists who are excited for each other. That was the thing that blew me away at the Oscars, was seeing all these people who are the top of their everything, so excited for each other and celebrating. Yeah, we tell stories. We are storytellers. That is what we do. The world is on fire. Everything is fucking terrible right now. And we turn to the storytellers to help us get a break from it and to help us process it and understand it. Rob Reiner made movies. Each movie is about something deeply meaningful and deeply personal to every person who sees it in a different way. And when we were out there for him and the theater was acknowledging him and remembering him and the whatever billion people around the world watching it are doing the same thing, there's just not many people who do what Rob did. Steven Spielberg comes to mind as someone who really tells stories that are somehow relatable in all these different ways for people who are in the audience. So with there being so many different things vying for attention right now, that so many people would turn their attention to that moment and show up and remember him. It was a real blessing and a real testament to his legacy and what he meant and means to so many people. Through the witches and slam, through the witches and slam.
I gotta tell you guys something. It's pretty embarrassing, and I'm kind of ashamed to admit it, but it's true. The rumors are true. What you've heard online is true. What's been in the tabloids is true. TMZ, I can't deny it. That's right. I have run out of my Lumi gummies. I've blown right through my stash, and I'm beside myself. And I need to rectify this situation immediately because my sleep schedule is already starting to slip back in its worst late night routine habits. You know Lumi, they have been our longest sponsor here at the KingCast. They are consistent, mellow, and super delicious. Lumi gummies are specifically designed to make you feel good, not stoned. Whether you're looking for an end-of-the-day de-stressor, a midday mood boost, or like me, help getting the best sleep ever, Lumi gummies has a strain that's right for you. Lumi gummies come in sativa, indica, and hybrid style, so however you want to take the edge off or get a relaxed, creative boost, they have an option for you. And they all taste good, which isn't something you can always guarantee with edibles, if you know, you know. I've been a customer of theirs since the very first time they advertised on the show, and I can tell you their product has only gotten better over the years. My favorite is the Orange Cream Cookie Sativa Gummy. For whatever reason, out of all the ones that I've tried, and I've tried a lot of them, believe you me, for whatever reason, that's the only one that helps me settle in when I'm ready for bedtime, and I'm sorely missing it now, I can tell you that. I guess it's time to place another order, and if you'd like to follow suit, pay attention to this part, it's important. Lumi Gummies are available nationwide, and you can get them at lumigummies.com, that's lumigummies.com, and use the code KINGCAST for 30% off of your order. Again, that's lumigummies.com, code KINGCAST, lumigummies.com, code KINGCAST. Now let's get back to the show, shall we?
I've got a theory for you I want to run by you. So okay. I asked you about what you make out of the similarity between their deaths, and you gave a very beautiful answer. And I'm thinking about this myself, like, what does that mean when something echoes another thing? And you used the word just now, relatability, that his movies, people could relate to them, even if you've never been in those situations, like there's a familiarity to it. And I think my theory is Rob was always stepping between people, right? From when he was very young and politically active as a teenager and as a 20-something, you know, playing Mike Stivic, the meathead from All in the Family. He was speaking from the heart. You know, he's playing a character there, but saying things he believes in, representing a progressive point of view. And throughout his life, he could have been one of these people that just tuned the world out and lived comfortably, but he was always stepping up, right? Stepping between, saying what he believed. And I want to connect that to another little coincidence. So check this out. I'm not the kind. I'm wearing a Stand By Me t-shirt with the U4 boys on it. And I'm not the kind of person to wear the band's t-shirt to the concert, you know? But
Right.
But I was about to change because this is just sort of like a comfy shirt for me. I was going to change because we're going to record the show, right? And then I realized, oh shit, I'm wearing this Stand By Me t-shirt. And I don't see that as like a cosmic coincidence. I just think I wear this all the time, right? It's always great. There. And so we've I think of Rob, this. Like he was always standing up for people. He was always sticking his neck out. And what he was doing that at home privately with his son too, to try to help him. And that's why this happened, because he didn't cast him away. Other parents might've done that, but he didn't. And I think, I guess I'm wondering what your take on that is. Is this evidence of just how Rob Reiner, like Chris Chambers, was willing to step up when others might have run away?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I didn't know his family at all, but I have talked to people who did. And, like, what comes up over and over and over again is how much Rob and Michelle love their kids. And I have two sons and a daughter-in-law, and I cherish them. I will do anything for them. They are my entire world. I'm doing my best to be the adult I needed. And I'm doing the best to be the person I wish there was more of in the world. And I can only imagine that Rob made the same choice. He never shied away from just like speaking the truth. And even when it was, you know, uncomfortable and unpopular. And it was never about chasing clout, and it was never about him. Right? It's always about something more. And that's the thing about great artists and great filmmakers. It's about the art And the point of the art is for the audience to feel something. I don't know, but the audience is going to decide what that is. It's to help us process and experience complicated emotions. Art shines a light on dark corners that we would rather not look in until the light is there and we cannot look away. And he absolutely was the kind of artist and the kind of filmmaker who did that. And that is, I mean, I think that that is very much the defining characteristic of any of the really great artists and storytellers that are doing such amazing work now and will, you know, long after we're all gone. They care deeply about people and care deeply about the complicated emotions we all feel. And in Rob and Michelle's case, care deeply about their children and love them and want to help them and want to give them mm-hmm. the very best life that they possibly can. You know, it is, of course, it is a coincidence, but I can very much see a parallel between the way Chris was to Gordy and what Rob was to me for that very, very brief time that I knew him. Mm. In the few months that I knew him and we worked together, I received more unconditional love and approval and support and praise than I ever got in my entire life from my own dad. And like nobody knew that at the time, you know? It's not like Rob was trying to make up for something that I was missing. That's just who he was.
I just think of the line, I wish I was your dad, right? Yeah. Like another echo with Chris.
It comes up a lot, you know, and I know that he talks, Rob spoke in interviews just about how the parallels that he felt with my character and sort of with me. I mean, I think about it all the time. Like I think he's directing me and he's seeing some of himself, and he's directing River and he's seeing some of himself. He's directing all of us and seeing some of himself, right? And pulling those little pieces out of himself and pulling them out of us.
In a positive way, I gotta underline here, because that the miracle of that movie to me, and the miracle of Stephen King's novella, is that it's a rare example of a non-toxic love between
100%.
It is boys at this age. Yeah. You know, it's so easy to, and it dips into, like, especially the novella, King novella, you know, there's some, say, era, still inappropriate, but more understandable terms that are thrown around that are the kid's bravado, the slagging on the mothers, like all right. that stuff is there. But like that is normally 90% of these kinds of stories. And in here, in both the novella and especially in the movie, which is, like you said, it's a little softer. You know, it focuses on that support structure. I mean, especially between Gordy and Chris. I mean, I think that's the meat there. But yeah, you know, that's what I always grab onto with this thing. And it's especially watching it at, you know, I was about the age you were when, you know, you made it, mm-hmm. when I saw the movie for the first time, maybe even a little younger. And I'd never really seen that, but it did reflect truth to how my friends and I were, right?
Every one of us has met people in the course of our lifetimes who told us how they saw themselves in the movie, and, oh, I did these things with my friends. It reminded me so much of my friends. And we would ask them, like, oh, did you grow up? Did you like go in the woods or whatever? Most of them were like, no, I lived in Cleveland, or I lived in Manhattan, or I lived in Sacramento. It was just because it's about the experience that we, you know, that people have at that age in their lives. And it's about it's that sort of universal archetypical experience that everybody has. It's interesting that you brought up, you know, there's parts of it that are, you know, problematic. They're appropriate. I mean, they are appropriate to the time. None of that stuff, I think, comes from a supremacist place. It just comes from a place that, like, you know, there's just kids are kind of like that when they're kids, right? And in the novella, there are two stories in the novella.
Oh, we're finally getting into Chico, aren't we?
You know, yeah. So, but I think it's really important, and I think it's a great thing that Stephen King does as well, and he calls himself out on it, right? That there's a story if you've only seen the movie, you don't know this, but there's a second story in the novella, and it's sort of like it's a reprint from like Cavalier or some kind of like men's magazine from like probably the 70s, And it's just, it's not great. It's pretty misogynist. The characters are paper thin and very tropey, and I narrate the whole thing and I'm like, ugh, as I'm narrating it, you know, but I know what's coming is then Gordon says, yeah, I don't know what the hell I was thinking. Like, this is, you know, this is gross. And this is, you know, I see where I like just didn't know what I was doing as a writer. And I didn't make these characters interesting. And this female character is just kind of like an idea there that just there to like kind of like give the dude like reasons, you know, and he really calls himself out on it, which I think is really wonderful. And it shows you his growth. It really, really illustrates his growth as a writer and his growth as a person. And I think that he calls himself out on that in the novella, that it is not part of the movie because it really just doesn't fit in the movie at all, very much supports that Stand By Me shows by example what healthy masculinity looks like. It shows healthy friendships. It shows that, you know, there's this weirdness. I don't know what it's like growing up right now. But for me, growing up in the 70s and in the 80s, I grew up in an environment where if you were sensitive and you were a boy, people really picked on you and were really cruel about it and you know, and really bullied. And there was this idea that boys are supposed to be tough and you know, all of these things that lead to what is really toxic masculinity that hurts men so much. And like, I mean, it definitely hurts women, but I think men who are leaning into it for comfort do not understand how much they are hurting themselves. And Stand By Me, made in the 80s, really showed that these boys can love each other as family loves each other, as friends love each other. It's not weird. It's okay to be sensitive. It's okay to be sad. It's okay to feel your feelings. And you shouldn't bury them, you know? And like, anger is an emotion. It's not, you know, like, it's all of these things are really appropriate for people to feel. It's one of the things in the book and in the movie that is just, it's a universal experience that we all have.
Yeah, and I was excited to hear you get to the Chico section specifically because it's from a writing point of view. Stephen King does this every once in a while. He's done it a few times that I've noticed in Billy Summers most recently, where it's the actor equivalent of like doing a bad audition or something. Like, you're not like portraying a bad audition, like an actor playing an actor doing a bad reading, right? So it's the writer version of that. It's like Emma Stone and La La Land blowing her audition or whatever. He does the writer version of that where if you go and you like really focus on the writing of that Chico story, you see it's not up to Stephen King standards, right? The grammar doesn't work as well. The, you know, it's overlong in some parts and too short in others. And like you said, the characters are thin, which is, you know, Stephen King has to try to write a thin character, right?
Yeah. It's like,
that's just how he is. And I guess my question here is, when you like, I know you were familiar with the novella when you were on the show the last time. You talked about being the only one of the kids that actually read it, you know, at the time of making the movie. Like, you went out of your way to do it. You've been familiar with it. But that's different than studying it specifically for this kind of, you know, word by word as you did going through this book. So when you got to that Chico section, was there something that stood out to you there? Did you notice, like, that shift, or were you just more gritting your teeth trying to get through it to get to that
I mean,
that,
you know,
postscript that he has on it?
I mean honestly it was I've had these experiences on the set, I've had these experiences on stage in live shows. I don't remember because I was so connected to the truth of the material. I was so disassociated from me, Gordon, that I don't really remember. I got there and I was like, okay. I mean, I know where this is going and I know how he feels about it, right? So the choice that I can kind of remember making is to stay connected to the simple truth of how he feels about it. Without tipping that too much to the listener, right? I can't be reading this and judging it while I'm reading it. I have to be reading it earnestly. Because when he wrote it and sold it, he did it earnestly and was probably really happy to sell it. And, mm-hmm. and was, you know, that was exciting. And is looking back on it now and is like, oh, well. So I wish that I had a great creative process answer for you. But my creative process answer is the material is so there and so available that I just committed to it. And I did my best to rise to the demands of the material and keep it simple.
I did notice your voice changed. You read that section a little bit differently than you read the rest of it. You get a little bit more gravelly. I noticed in your voice. So I'm assuming that's the trying to get like, okay, this is the hard boiled story, the John D. McDonald inspired thing.
It's exactly that. And that's, I think, you know, when Gordon writes that story, he's thinking about that.
Yeah, that's the voice
right?
in his head.
And that's just sort of like, he's like, yeah, you know, I kind of had, he probably, you know, as a writer, I might see a scene in a somewhere. And that scene will plant itself in my head. And while I'm not paying attention, it grows into its own story that needs to be told. And at some point, Gordon planted that story in his head. You know, grew it to the best of his ability and was like, I don't know, it's not great.
Probably assumed it would have been the favorite story of his for Teddy, that Teddy would have loved that story.
Teddy would have been crazy about that story. There's a great thing in the novella also when Gordy tells the story of Lardash, you know, and Teddy's like, well, that ending sucks. And then Gordon goes into a little bit of, there's a couple of paragraphs of Gordon talking about how he would tell these stories to Teddy, and they're all the same, but Teddy doesn't care. And they're like, you know, they're the stories that Teddy needed to hear, you know, at that time, which I think reveals a great deal about Gordon's character and Gordy's character as well, you know, like not character as in fictional character. I mean, character as in ethical and moral character. It's like, yeah, I care about my friends and I want to tell them stories that they're going to like. Even if I'm like, oh God, here we go with another one of the Battle in Leathernecks. Okay.
Yep.
Well, the story, the novella tells you, it shows how people, how kids, they learn to be who they are by imitation. You know, if you don't have good role models in your life, you don't know how to be.
Yeah.
And you go astray. And writing stories is the same way, you know. They have their collection, their stash of detective magazines. And the story Gordy is reading at the beginning when Vern comes in all breathless with his news of this dead boy that he knows the location.
It's a big part of Gordy's character. Gordy loves the detective magazines. He loves the hard-boiled detective novels. He loves to read true crime. I grabbed one of those magazines off the set with permission so that I could read it. And I found it to be really difficult to read. A lot of those stories are they're violent and they're lurid and they're uncomfortable. And you see and like you just think about like Gordy loves those stories, you know.
He writes one. That's the story he writes. That's what you're reading.
Yeah. But I knew when I don't remember why I knew. It was such a big part of his story, you know, his character, his backstory, his existence. I don't remember why I knew that, but I read as much of those stuff, those things as I could, because I thought it probably affects how he talks. And you know, he's like flip or eat lead, you know, just like things like that, right? Just there are little suggestions of who he is before we even meet him, and that's one of them. And I just thought it would be interesting to know a little bit more about like what his influences were. And when you read those things, like Chico's story, it's a very short, very straight walk from the page, you know, the pages of like whatever that detective magazine was to that story. It's a lovely part of the novella. Before we did this at a little meeting with one of the producers at the publisher, cause she works with Stephen King. On a lot of things. And, you know, Stephen King is an author we love, and he is a creator who means a great deal to us. Stephen King is also a multi-billion dollar global industry, and his publisher needs to protect that and cares deeply about how all that works. And It's been a very, very, very long time since I felt I was in a meeting with someone who was a little nervous about what I was going to do and like wasn't quite sure that I understood the assignment. And the assignment was the novella is different from the movie. I knew that. The assignment was tell Gordon LaChance's story from The Body. You're not going to tell Gordy LaChance's story from Stand By Me. They overlap a lot. They blur together a lot, but they are distinctly different stories. And it was very important to me and to Gabrielle and to everyone at Simon & Schuster. And if Stephen King is paying attention, it probably matters to him a little bit at least that this novella that he wrote in the 70s is honored and accurately reflected, and that story is told as fully and as emotionally true as the story when we told that the Stand By Me version of this story. And like I felt good. Like I felt smart and I felt accomplished when I was like, I think I know what you want. Let me tell you what I'm going for. Right. And the other half of the meeting was like, great, let's get to work. You know, I could see that I could feel that, like, you know, coming from like, you know, the corner office on the 51st floor or whatever, you know, I could feel this like, all right, you know, we don't know how actors are and we don't know how artists are and we don't know how this guy's going to be. And we got to be like, really, you know, we got to like really, you know, look after you, whatever, you know, they were like unsure how it was going to go. Right. And I was like, y'all, I get this. I really know what I'm doing. I promise you. And I think that we ended up with something very special. You know, this could easily be stunt casting, right? If I was not an audiobook narrator, this could just be stunt casting. And you know, that has its place, right? But this happens to be a moment in my life where this is what I do. And this is how I express my art. This is how my artistic self is filled up and satisfied. And like, it's just such a privilege to have been given the permission and the support and the enthusiastic support to really celebrate this and just get it to as many people as we possibly can. I can't remember. I've been saying this a lot lately. Forgive me if I said it already while we were talking. So many entertainers will live their entire lives and spend their entire entertainment careers hoping for something like Stand By Me.
Mm-hmm.
Hoping for something that matters to an audience. Hoping you don't dare dream that you will be in something that matters to more than one generation. Because that's impossible. It doesn't happen. But Stand By Me does. And The Body does. And I'm just so grateful. And I'm so lucky to have had that to stand on for my entire life, that I've been able to build on that for my entire life. I said earlier that everything that's good in my life started with Rob Reiner and Stand By Me. And what I am doing in my life right now, I'm the happiest I've ever been. I'm the most fulfilled I've ever been. I love being a narrator. I love that I get to narrate short fiction for my podcast every week. I love that I am helping find authors who are brilliant artists who are beautiful storytellers and bringing their work to an audience where their number one fan doesn't yet know that there's a new person that they're going to love in their life. I just love that it starts with Stand By Me in 1985. And there's a long meandering journey with so much. And it all comes right back around to here 40 years later. We've got Stand By Me live on tour. Sony is re-releasing Stand By Me in theaters. And The Body is coming out, in just a week, and that I am here right now. It feels really good. It's a real gift. And you know, I am choosing in this moment, like, to really, really be grateful for this and be grateful that I get to share this experience with so many people for whom this movie really means something. It's just a real, it's a gift, it's a blessing. And I really, really hope that the narration of the audiobook, I really hope that it lands on an audience the way the movie landed on audiences, and the way, you know, I just hope that it, that people make a connection to it, the same way that they've connected to the movie.
You know, one of the people that is in that category of folks who are deeply moved by this film is Stephen King himself. You know, he's made no secret. You talk about the differences between the book and the movie. I actually don't see tremendous differences. Like, there are some subtle differences, mm-hmm. some specific differences, but he adores this movie and sees it as a good representation. There's no like he is with The Shining, where like, well, that's not my story, you know. He sees
it's so interesting, right? Like, Kubrick's The Shining is an incredible movie that is just an appallingly bad adaptation of the book, right? The Long Walk is a great adaptation of the book that I did not enjoy as a movie, right? Mm. Stand By Me manages to thread the needle.
And whenever I talk to Steve and he mentions The Body, he doesn't call it The Body. He calls it Stand By Me. Talking about his book, he always calls it Stand By Me.
Oh my God, I didn't know that.
Yeah. I don't know if he does that for any particular reason, or if he just, you know, I kind of think Stand By Me is the better title.
You know, it's so funny.
Maybe he wishes he thought of that, you know?
So we finished the movie in August of 1985. And then we shot a couple of pickups, I think, in September of 1985. And then the movie didn't come out for a year. While we were waiting for it to come out, they changed the name. It was The Body when we shot it. And they changed the name. And I remember when they found out they were changing the name, 13-year-old Will was mad. I was like, well, The Body's a cool name,
yeah,
right? So, you know, The Body, it's cool, it's scary, whatever. Somebody explained, like, yeah, but this is why. Like, oh, okay, that makes sense. I totally understand.
Well, they didn't want to scare people with Stephen King.
Yeah. What I do remember is at some point in the late 80s, and it would have been after I had started doing Star Trek, I read an interview with Stephen King. He said that Stand By Me was his favorite adaptation of anything that he had written. So it's before Misery, because then Misery, you know, another Rob Reiner movie, not by coincidence. That knowledge, knowing that, and I'm a fan of his, right? Like, I mean, I'm a huge fan of his. Knowing that he had seen what we did, and that he felt good about it, and, you know, and that he felt like we had done him proud, we had done him right. That has always meant so much to me.
One of the things I loved listening to your narration again was hitting upon things that went by me when I was a young person and read this book. Things like Gordy mentions that he goes to the store to buy a new John D. MacDonald novel, but all of the ones on the rack are ones he already has. And that reminded me of how I used to go to the grocery store and look for paperbacks of Stephen King's to buy.
Hey, yeah.
You know,
the little spinning yeah. rack, right? Like, that's where I got Night Shift, Skeleton Crew, Carrie. Like, after Stand By Me, I just went all the way back to Cujo. And then I just went forward. I would go to B. Dalton Booksellers in the mall.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Or Walden Books in the mall.
Walden Books.
I remember. Right? And I would get those covers. And then remember, there was a moment where when Stand By Me came out, they did new covers for all the books, mm-hmm. and they put a train on the cover of Step. Yeah. They put all new covers on the books. So I went back to the bookstore and I bought all the new books so that I could have the new covers to stay current. I have a first edition of Different Seasons in my collection, that I absolutely cherish, that lives with, you know, a few other books that are really, really important to me. It's the only, you know, first edition, I have from that era. Cause everything else I read in paperback.
Right. I love the paperbacks. That's the trade paperbacks. Yeah. But what's so cool about the John D. MacDonald thing is also, I know from talking to Steve what John D. MacDonald means to him. You know, and MacDonald had written the intro to Night Shift. He loved his book so much. And he also name checks, not the novel, but he references Dandelion Wine, which is another great coming of age story, which echoes that and Something Wicked This Way Comes. The Ray Bradbury childhood stories are echoed in The Body. And I thought, oh, he's referencing the things he loved in his own story. Now he's someone another generation and multiple generations love. And it called to mind Stranger Things. And in the final season, they invoke the line, "Suck my fat one."
Did they really?
Yeah.
So I'll be honest with you. I loved the first season of Stranger Things. I found the second season to be so derivative and uninspired.
you checked that I just out then, huh? out
And I was like, you know what? I'm not in the demo anymore. I will always have that first season. It's beautiful. And there are moments in that first season that are visually inspired by Stand By Me. Like there are shots in that movie that are clear in that series that are clearly taken from us. So many people have made the connection between the way Eleven looks and the way Gordy looks, you know, mm-hmm. like there are a lot of those parallels. I had no idea that they said "suck my fat one" in the final season. That is amazing.
They did. We watched it with my son, I said, "Remember this line," because he hasn't seen Stand By Me yet. I'm like, "Remember
that
this
is
line."
Absolutely incredible. Mm-hmm. I love that.
What was it like getting to that point in the book? Because it's such a break. It's not like it's a vulgarity, right? But it's like this great breakthrough moment for Gordy. What was it like getting back to that now compared to then?
When we did that scene, you know, Gordy has all the power in that scene.
Yeah, you got to be Clint Eastwood in that scene, right?
And it's not because he has a gun.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
because he's done being afraid.
Yeah.
He's just done being afraid. He's come this far. He's come through all these things. He has just confronted the biggest reality in the hardest truth in his life. And he has all the power in that scene because he is just out of fucks to give.
Mm.
And I was a little kid and I didn't know. And my instinct was to go big.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember Rob Reiner saying, "Hey, listen." He comes over and he goes, "Just listen to me." And I said, "Okay." And he says, "Kiefer, say whatever." Kiefer says his line, and then Rob yells at him, yells my line back at him. He says, "Okay, now watch. Go again." Kiefer says it, and Rob says, just steely cold and quiet and reserved, the exact same line. And he says, "Which one's scarier?" And I said, "Oh, the second one." And he said, "Yeah, do you know why?" And I said, "Oh, because he's not scared. He's gonna shoot him." And Rob says, "Yeah, and Ace knows that."
Mm.
And it's an example of Rob coming to me and helping me find a performance and helping me find a truthful, honest performance in the film. And that's just one of many moments like that when he made that effort with all of us at different points to do that. So when I got to that part, you know, when I get to that in the book, I was just remembering that. And I was just remembering like what it was like to prepare that scene, you know, for the movie. It was a lot. It hung over me for the entirety of production. It was, you know, we didn't shoot it until close to the end. And, you know, like every day I was so afraid that I wasn't going to be able to rise to the occasion. I was afraid that I was going to let him down, that I wasn't going to get there. And by the time we got to that scene, I was so wound up and filled with emotions that I sobbed in rehearsal. It was, you know, like just getting back to that scene in the book again is one of those moments where I was just so connected to the material and I was so focused on being truthful and honest and simple that I don't remember. I don't remember I don't remember making clear choices. I just remember being very, very connected to what is clear in the text, but also to the direction and advice that I'd been given by Rob 40 years ago to make that scene really, really sing.
Will, you killed it with the narration. Obviously, you've been a part of cinema history. You know, the you know, I'll echo what Bresnikan said earlier, that, you know, it's really wonderful that you were so open about, you know, talking about Rob here with us today. It means a lot to me. I'm sure you made the listeners cry. I know I was tearing up. So, you know, it's wonderful that you're, you know, I love having you on the show, man. And I'm also going to announce here, we haven't talked about it yet, but Will and I are going to start a Fallout 76 podcast together where all we do is talk about whatever, you know, repetitive daily task that we're still doing.
Let's go get some Bert books.
reroll.
Everybody in the audience who knows what Eric and I are talking about, it's such a great place to be, isn't it?
It's
a great place to be.
Yeah, we're going to now become best friends in the wasteland, and we're going to be helping newbies with fresh water and high-powered armor.
And lots of grenades.
Yes, and a bunch of plasma grenades. Yeah. But thanks so much for coming on, man. It does mean a lot. And, you know,
Thank you.
I love having you on for many reasons, but, you know, the main of which is that, you know, you're always not afraid to be you. You're not afraid to be geeky or emotional or whatever, you know, in that moment. And it's very refreshing. And,
you know, you care about this stuff. You care about it. And it comes through.
I really, really do. I really, really, really do. And it really matters to me that you get that. And, you know, and to everyone in the audience who also gets it, just thank you. Thank you for making it possible for me to do what I do. I'm really, really grateful for it.
Do you want to do one more plug for where people can find this reading and when it's available?
Yeah,
and you can also plug your podcast.
It's Story Time. Okay. It's a great podcast. So, Will, I should have mentioned that in my intro.
Thank you so much. So, so let me just give you a tiny little bit about me. if you would like to find me on the internet, my blog has been in the same place for over 20 years. It's willwheaton.net. And that's a great place. If you only want to remember one thing, you can go there for everything. It's where I write about my life and I write my essays and I have links to the things that I'm doing. My narration of the novella, The Body, is available wherever you get your audiobooks on March 24th. My podcast, It's Storytime with Will Wheaton, is a weekly speculative fiction podcast. I read short stories from wonderful speculative fiction authors, sci-fi and fantasy, some weird fiction. New episodes drop every Wednesday, wherever you get your podcasts. And there's a link to the podcast at my homepage. Corey and Jerry and I are on tour with Stand By Me. We have a few dates left this year, and you can find out all about that at standbymelive.com. We have shows coming up in Anaheim, Portland, and Seattle, and then Chicago and Indianapolis later in the year. We've been doing this, we've done like 6 shows since last year, and it's wonderful. We screen the movie, we all watch it together, then Dan Pasternak moderates a discussion afterward where we share our memories and tell our stories, and we take some questions from the audience, and then we have a little VIP photo thing afterwards, which is lovely. People come up and cosplay, and like Bez, I've been seeing so many incredible, like definitely not official t-shirts that are made, you know, that people are grabbing off of Etsy or TeePublic or whatever, but they're just wonderful expressions of people's love for this movie. And I love to see things like that, right? It's just like fan art that celebrates what we did. And Stand By Me is going to be back in theaters at the end of this month also. We're having a really lovely Stand By Me moment as we celebrate 40 years of it. I'm so grateful that you asked me to come in and talk about it and share this with all of your listeners. Like I said, I'm Will at willwheaton.net. I really love hearing about what this movie means to people and why.
That's beautifully said, Will. I'm going to quote one of the great lines from this book and from the movie.
Yeah.
I never had any friends later on like the ones I had when I was 12. You've been a friend of people ever since we were 12 years old, Will. Thank you for still being our friend and bringing this story back around.
It is a privilege and a pleasure.
Many thanks to Will Wheaton for coming back and being so emotionally open with us. It's not easy to dive into the territory that he did with Brez and I. And even though I thanked him a couple dozen times at the end of the episode, I want to thank him once more for it. Didn't have to go there. He did. And we very much appreciate it. Now, if you've stuck around this long, odds are you want to hear some of his reading from the body. And I am about to deliver that to you. Let me get two pieces of housekeeping out of the way first. First, I want to let you guys know that this reading of the body, the audiobook, is available right now anywhere you get your audiobooks, whether it's Spotify, Apple Books, Google Play, or Audible, that kind of stuff. You can also get it direct at simonandschuster.com. And I think after you hear his reading, you're going to want to do that. There's something very special about hearing, you know, the guy who embodies Gordon LaChance for all of us that grew up with Stand By Me, actually doing the adult narration of it. So that's housekeeping piece number one. Housekeeping piece number two, I got to plug the Patreon real quick. I won't take long. Here's the quick version of it. The KinkCast Patreon, it's the best way to support the show. If you dig what we're doing around here, we have over 5 years worth of bonus episodes, 90% of which have never been made available outside of the Patreon. So if you want more, that's where you can go get it. Throw us a few bucks every month and we'll make sure it's worth your while. Sign up at patreon.com/thekingcast right now. So why don't we all gather around the campfire, pop a cherry flavor Pez, and listen to Uncle Gordy reminisce about his childhood. You're about to get, I believe it's a little over 8 minutes of an excerpt from the train bridge sequence. I think it's pretty great. I think it's a great example of what Will brings to this reading. And thank you once again to Simon and Schuster for providing it and letting the KingCast listeners get a little tiny taste. Enjoy Will Wheaton reading Stephen King's The Body.
We went out onto the trestle single file. Chris first, then Teddy, then Vern, and me playing tail end Charlie because I was the one who said dares go first. We walked on the platform cross ties between the rails, and you had to look at your feet whether you were scared of heights or not. A misstep and you would go down on your crotch, probably with a broken ankle to pay. The embankment dropped away beneath me, and every step further out seemed to seal our decision more firmly and to make it feel more suicidally stupid. I stopped to look up when I saw the rocks giving way to water far beneath me. Chris and Teddy were a long way ahead, almost out over the middle, and Vern was tottering slowly along behind them, peering studiously down at his feet. He looked like an old lady trying out stilts, with his head poked downward, his back hunched, his arms held out for balance. I looked back over my shoulder. Too far, man. I had to keep going now, and not only because a train might come. If I went back, I'd be a pussy for life. So I got walking again. After looking down at that endless series of crossties for a while, with a glimpse of running water between each pair, I started to feel dizzy and disoriented. Each time I brought my foot down, part of my brain assured me it was going to plunge through into space, even though I could see it was not. I became acutely aware of all the noises inside me and outside me, like some crazy orchestra tuning up to play. The steady thump of my heart. The blood beat in my ears like a drum being played with brushes. The creak of sinews like the strings of a violin that has been tuned radically upward. The steady hiss of the river. The hot hum of a locust digging into tight bark. The monotonous cry of a chickadee. And somewhere, far away, a barking dog. Chopper, maybe. The mildewy smell of the Castle River was strong in my nose. The long muscles in my thighs were trembling. I kept thinking how much safer it would be, probably faster as well, if I just got down on my hands and knees and scuttered along that way. But I wouldn't do that. None of us would. If the Saturday matinee movies down to the gem had taught us anything, it was that only losers crawl. It was one of the central tenets of the gospel according to Hollywood. Good guys walk firmly upright. And if your sinews are creaking like overtimed violin strings because of the adrenaline rush going on in your body, and if the long muscles in your thighs are trembling for the same reason, why, so be it. I had to stop in the middle of the trestle and look up at the sky for a while. That dizzy feeling had been getting worse. I saw phantom cross ties. They seemed to float right in front of my nose. Then they faded out and I began to feel okay again. I looked ahead and saw I had almost caught up with Vern, who was slow poking along worse than ever. Chris and Teddy were almost all the way across. And although I've since written 7 books about people who can do such exotic things as read minds and precognite the future, that was when I had my first and last psychic flash. I'm sure that's what it was. How else to explain it? I squatted and made a fist around the rail on my left. It thrummed in my hand. It was thrumming so hard that it was like gripping a bundle of deadly metallic snakes. You've heard it said, his bowels turned to water. I know what that phrase means. Exactly what it means. It may be the most accurate cliche ever coined. I've been scared since, badly scared. But I've never been as scared as I was in that moment, holding that hot live rail. It seemed that, for a moment, all my works below throat level just went limp and lay there in an internal faint. A thin stream of urine ran listlessly down the inside of one thigh. My mouth opened. I didn't open it. It opened by itself, the jaw dropping like a trap door from which the hinge pins had suddenly been removed. My tongue was plastered suffocatingly against the roof of my mouth. All my muscles were locked. That was the worst. My works went limp, but my muscles were in a kind of dreadful lock bolt, and I couldn't move at all. It was only for a moment, but in the subjective time stream, it seemed forever. All sensory input became intensified, as if some power surge had occurred in the electrical flow of my brain, cranking everything up from 110 volts to 220. I could hear a plane passing in the sky somewhere near and had time to wish I was on it, just sitting in a window seat with a Coke in my hand and gazing idly down at the shining line of a river whose name I did not know. I could see every little splinter and gouge in the tarred crosstie I was squatting on, and out of the corner of my eye, I could see the rail itself, with my hand still clutched around it, glittering insanely. The vibration from that rail sank so deeply into my hand that when I took it away, it still vibrated, the nerve endings kicking each other over again and again, tingling the way a hand or foot tingles when it has been asleep and starting to wake up. I could taste my saliva, suddenly all electric and sour and thickened to curds along my gums. And worst, somehow, most horrible of all, I couldn't hear the train yet. Could not know if it was rushing at me from ahead or behind or how close it was. It was invisible. It was unannounced, except for that shaking rail. There was only that to advertise its imminent arrival. An image of Ray Brower, dreadfully mangled and thrown into a ditch somewhere like a ripped open laundry bag, reeled before my eyes. We would join him, or at least Vern and I would, or at least I would. We had invited ourselves to our own funerals. The last thought broke the paralysis, and I shot to my feet. I probably would have looked like a jack-in-the-box to anyone watching. But to myself, I felt like a boy in underwater slow motion shooting up, not through 5 feet of air, but rather up through 500 feet of water, moving slowly, moving with dreadful languidness as the water parted grudgingly. But at last, I did break the surface. I screamed, "Train!"
The KingCast is hosted by Eric Vespi, that's me, and Anthony Bresnikan. The show is produced by myself as well as Abby Goel and Tara Ansley, and is distributed by the Fangoria Podcast Network. Daniel Danger is our art director, and the show was created by me, the late, great Scott Wampler.